Good Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a pretty good start so far. 10:06 is the time right now. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. We'll talk science this hour. It's time now for Science Files this morning, and St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker is back with us today, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. Coming up next hour, your chance to sound off. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up after 11. We call it Manic Monday, and as always, anything goes. After the news at noon, some 300,000 Nova Scotians of Scottish descent are urged to express their Scottishness via the .Scott domain online. The .Scott Registry's Harry McGrath will explain. And another Halifax History Moment is coming up this afternoon with Halifax historian and author, Mr. Blair Bede. But this hour, it is time for Science Files, and joining me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker, who is going to tell us here right now how he strained his...
I'm getting old. No, so I woke up with a hamstring pull, and watch for those sleep twitches. They can be really painful. I was just sort of like rolling over in bed, and I had a sleep twitch, and lo and behold, I'd managed to pull my hamstring, which is massively embarrassing, but there we go.
There you go. Yeah. But you're here, and... you're here to answer any questions.
Absolutely.
Talk science,
call in with your questions.
902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255.
Yes.
Cosmic Crisp, new Apple watch
yeah.
that lasts for a year. I was watching.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. But the report that I watched on TV the other night just suggested these are apples that it takes a much longer time to turn brown.
Yeah. So, that's refrigerated as well. They won't last for a year, just sort of like sitting on the side of your desk. But no, this is actually out of Washington State.
Mm.
And so it's a breeding program. Apparently, it's been going on for quite a long time, since 1997. And they finally hit the jackpot. Woo!
Yeah.
So this new apple is a combination of, I think it's Honeycrisp and, what is it, Enterprise, I think, is the other apple. So it's supposed to look sort of like similar to Red Delicious and still be like really crispy. Sometimes Red Delicious can get a bit floury and flaky on you.
Yep.
And so this one is supposed to be really crispy and really good. Mm. Now, all of that said, the sting in the tail of this story, as I mentioned to you just a few minutes ago, is why are we hearing about this? Well, other than the apple might last a really long time, there's a big promotional campaign behind it.
Yeah, an expensive promotional
exactly.
campaign.
Exactly. And it's got into the, it's in the international literature. Actually, I saw this first on the BBC, even though this is a Washington State apple. So I guess we'll wait and see just how good it is. And sounds like there's a lot of possibilities for putting it in different growing conditions, different areas, and maybe it is as good as they say.
You say it's a cross between the Honeycrisp and Enterprise apples,
yeah.
But Honeycrisp was developed here in Nova Scotia, was it not, if I'm not mistaken?
I don't actually know if it was developed here. I know there's a few people growing them here. Yeah. But,
yeah. And farmers in the state of Washington, by the way, are exclusively allowed to grow this fruit, this Cosmic Crisp, for the next decade. That's interesting. That, and I understand it will not be available in Canada until late 2020 or early 2021.
Mm, so, well, I guess some of the ones they pick now, we might be getting then.
Maybe so. That's right.
But I like the name. So the name comes from the sort of flecking on the apple, and people thought, "Ooh, that looks kind of cosmic."
Yeah. More than 12 million Cosmic Crisp trees have already been planted. And a strict licensing system does not permit farmers to grow the apples in other parts of the country.
They've had it for 2 years, apparently. They've been growing it for 2 years.
So stay tuned.
So I'm a little bit surprised they won't let it grow elsewhere. Why would you do that?
Good question. It doesn't really explain here, other than they have exclusive rights for a decade to grow this. And it's just, I guess.
Maybe it's artificially trying to keep the price of this up if it's really good.
Perhaps so. We'll see if we can find out the answer to that. Just says here, Washington is the biggest producer of apples in the U.S., but its most popular varieties, the Golden Delicious and the Red Delicious, have been facing fierce competition now from other brands of apples, other species of apples, and so they've been developing these different types, and they've come up with Cosmic Crisp, the new apple that will last for at least a year, they claim.
So it is probably about keeping their prices where they want them to be.
I would imagine. Now, the spacewalk underway up in space on the International Space Station, Dr. Rob. Italy's astronaut that's on board, Luca Parmitano, and NASA's Andrew Morgan are up in space. They're repairing the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer This is a device that basically is a cosmic ray detector. They're looking at it, looking for antimatter and dark matter. Tell us about these things.
Yeah, well, basically, it's a good place to put a detector like this above the atmosphere, so you don't have to worry about things colliding with the atmosphere. That is actually kind of like our safety blanket, if you like, from all of the cosmic radiation there is out there. The sun is really one of the strongest sources that we have nearby to us, because that's actually releasing lots of very fast-moving particles off it every time you get a solar flare. And actually, when you get a solar flare and it actually interacts with the Earth's magnetic field, that's when we get really beautiful aurora.
Yeah, the magnetic field bounces those cosmic rays.
Yeah, it basically funnels them to around the poles, and then you see all of the aurora and so on. But there are other sorts of cosmic rays that come from the universe around us, from very, very high energy processes, things like neutron stars, black holes, and so on, suddenly emitting huge amounts of radiation at some point and sending particles all the way across the universe to us. And so having something that's detecting all of this stuff above the atmosphere is a really good way of actually making sure interacting with the atmosphere doesn't change it into another type of particle, create an air shower, and so on. So this is something that's been up there for a while. I haven't kept up to date on the actual results from this, if I'm completely honest. There's a lot of cosmic ray experiments going on around the world. But nonetheless, it's going to be a long and difficult spacewalk by the sound of it. Yeah. So I wouldn't, well, I don't know. Would I, you know, I actually quite would like to do a spacewalk.
Would you really?
Yeah,
that means you'd have to go up into space first.
I know, but sort of like being out there and just sort of like a few millimeters of protection between you and the vacuum of space and being able to look down
right
on the Earth, that would be kind of cool.
NASA compares these spacewalks, by the way, as the most complex since the Hubble Space Telescope missions. They're comparing it to heart surgery because this spectrometer apparently was never meant for hands-on repairs like this.
Yeah, so... I'm a little bit skeptical about that because so when the Hubble was built, people thought, okay, we'll never do any kind of really detailed repairs in orbit, so we can just use really fancy little screws here and there and so on. We don't need to worry about making them accessible for someone basically with huge gloves on. And then we had all of the problems with Hubble, as everyone knows, very embarrassing for NASA and so on. But they decided, well, the only way to fix this is actually to do that kind of engineering. And so they had to develop tools that would allow the astronauts to actually get out these really tiny little screws out of all of the circuit boards and remove things and so on. And so we learned a lesson from that to be prepared for actually having to do some kind of space-based maintenance on things. So I'm a little bit surprised to hear them say, oh, this is just as hard as Hubble, because I would have hoped that we had learned the lesson from Hubble, right?
Maybe not. So, yeah. Maybe not. 10:15 is the time. He is Dr. Rob, and this is another edition of Science Files here on a Monday morning. And if you've got a comment or a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also reach us via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a comment or a question, our Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. We'll be back with more with Dr. Rob Thacker right after this quick break. 10:17 here on a Monday morning with Dr. Rob Thacker and Science Files. Again, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're going to delve now into conspiracy theories, and kind of coincidentally, you mentioned this as a potential topic here, and I just got an email from Ian who talks about one of the more popular conspiracy theories, and that is that the Twin Towers did not fall to the ground because of the hijackings of the planes that crashed into them, and I won't go into all the details about others, but this study that you have here, researchers have now looked into this whole world of online conspiracy theories and have concluded that most of the people who believe or talk about these theories aren't your basic wackos. You're just regular, ordinary kind of folks.
Aren't your basic wackos. That's a lovely way to describe it, isn't it? So this is a really interesting study. And I, having said that, I've looked at it and I think there are a few issues with it. But anyway, so this is from some researchers at the Australian National University, very reputable university in Australia. So they said, okay, we've got a whole bunch of comments on Reddit this big online forum, and one of the Reddits that people go to extensively is the conspiracy forum, and it covers everything. It covers things from UFOs, 9/11, political conspiracy, and so on. And so even that ridiculous thing, Pizzagate. I mean, crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's come out of this is that the average person who seems to go and post on this particular Reddit versus posting on other Reddits doesn't seem to be particularly different in any way. And so there is a sort of like question you can say, is this just basically some people having fun with this, right? As opposed to people who are actually really obsessed with this.
Yep.
And so one of the things that they are very quick to point out is if you look at coverage of conspiracy theorists before online forums like this, it tended to be the people who were most outspoken who would be the ones who were picked up by the media because it was such a story, right? And so they would deliberately pick on people who were sort of like really out there and were kind of evangelical about their beliefs and so on. And in some cases, as we are all too well aware, there are people who go and do very unusual and very strange things living in places and very far away from other people and so on. And okay, those are unusual people. But this is sort of like showing that there is a more and wider interest in conspiracy theories than perhaps we had appreciated. And there aren't any simple explanations for it. Like so the psychologists have looked at, are there sort of like cognitive things that attract people to conspiracies? Or are there just a certain group of people who show certain traits, like a general, what's the best one? So a general distrust of power and things like that.
Yep.
And so apparently that actually does kind of correlate with people's interest in conspiracy, apparently. So anyway, so they've gone and looked at all of these things and they don't have anything that's really conclusive out of it. And I'm not entirely surprised by that because there's a lot of comments, and it's very difficult to say one comment means X and one comment means Y. So it's very difficult to do this textual analysis, but I'm sure we'll start to see more of it over the future as text processing gets better and better. So I found that kind of interesting. But one thing that they did say is there tended to be a link between these people posting on political forums and posting on conspiracy forums.
There
tended to be a little bit of a link there, yeah.
I'm looking here, the lead author of the study, a Dr. Colin Klein, says conspiracy theorists aren't always a bunch of, quote, crackpots wearing tinfoil hats. I might have used the term wackles, but that's a similar kind of comparison here. They're not crackpots wearing, because that's the impression you get when you hear
that's how the media has kind of like shown these people to be. I mean, so I can see, or I have interacted on forums with people that I would kind of call conspiracy theorists, even though they wouldn't want that label themselves.
Yep.
And so these are actually very intelligent individuals who nonetheless start looking for patterns in things and then extrapolating those patterns. And in particular, there are people who, with that distrust of authority being a very common thing that you see, start to believe that any established hierarchy of power is basically the way it is because it's been sort of like conspiring and so on. And so you see this with some particularly intelligent individuals who will really, really understand the details of like, I don't know, electronics or something like that. But then when it comes to the real world, that kind of framework that they understand their day-to-day work gets extrapolated into looking at political situations and things like that. And then they start believing in things. Now, the thing that about conspiracy theories is they are set up in such a way that you can't disprove them, right? And that's another one of their attractions, right? They are such a sort of well-manufactured ideology, for want of a better term, that there's nothing you can do to disprove it because you're not involved in it, so you don't have the evidence and you can't provide the evidence.
They make a good case at times for the arguments
So they are deliberately meant to be undefeatable with any kind of rhetoric argument, right? Mm. And so in that situation, if you want to believe a particular thing and you know that there is nothing that can be shown to disprove this thing, then that can be actually quite attractive to some people, right? And so it's very difficult, and it is they are very difficult memes in some cases to break down. And I mean, like the whole Apollo 11 faked moon landing stuff and so on. So you see all of that, and then the people go, well, they're just protecting it, aren't they? That's how they say that there's nothing you can do to disprove it, because they're just protecting it, because they've been paid so much money NASA, and they have to keep the secret.
So right? Just NASA arguing. But here's another conspiracy theory that was making the rounds before the 2016 election. That was Obama wasn't born in the United States. And despite the fact that Obama produced his birth certificate, there was still a credible amount of people out there who believed
it. Right, exactly. And so there's no way you can disprove that because, it's a fake birth certificate, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so that is the general sort of like structure of conspiracy theories that is attractive to some people. And you can understand why. I mean, I've written about this in a couple of articles. I mean, they are built in such a way that you can't disprove them. And when you have something that you can't disprove, right, that's attractive, right? And so it's not surprising that some people do get drawn to these things.
I think Rick wants to offer up a comment here this morning on conspiracy theories. Good morning, Rick.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Two things. One, the term conspiracy theory, as I pointed out to you, Mr. Howe, several years ago, was developed by the CIA regarding the JFK assassination and the Warren Report. And they were told that... Basically, the idea is to tell people that it couldn't happen because too many people would talk. Anyway, that's point number one. Point number two, Dr. Robb's colleagues at the University of Alaska Fairbanks just did a 2-year study regarding Building 7, World Trade Center Building 7. And their study, I certainly encourage you to go look at it online and report back, because it's a study based on physics, and I know Dr. Robb knows physics.
All right.
Okay.
So there you go, folks.
Thank you, Rick. Dr. Robb, you going to check that out?
I'll have a look, sure.
All right. And Bob just emailed and said that watching the Apollo 11 on TV referenced the moon landing and all the videos. He says, I noticed there were no stars visible. Are stars visible while traveling through space, he wonders.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, you're up on the space station, you can see stars.
So the thing to remember is that when you're up in the sky, so these are basically using a camera that's basically capturing the blackness and isn't exposing to capture light sources, right? And that's the fundamental issue. Hmm. Okay.
902-405-6000 and 1-877-801-8255. Dr. Robb Thacker is with us here on this Monday morning with another edition of Science Files. We had three conservative premiers, Ontario's Doug Ford, Saskatchewan's Scott Moe, and New Brunswick's Blaine Higgs, meet this weekend on the eve of the First Minister's gathering with the Prime Minister, their annual meeting with the Prime Minister. Anyway, the premiers of Ontario, Saskatchewan, and New Brunswick committed to collaborate on developing nuclear reactor technology. They're calling this, again, small modular reactors.
Yeah.
What can you tell me?
So this is actually something that has become very popular in the energy industry right now. And so many people who know about nuclear plants will be aware these plants tend to be huge, tend to, in some cases, have more than one reactor. And what there is an interest now is building smaller reactors that instead of producing hundreds and hundreds of megawatts can produce like tens to 100 and should be effectively much, much quicker to build. Cheaper is a relative term. They will obviously be cheaper than these massive installations Pickering in Ontario and so on. So this is something that I kind of wonder about, whether this is more coming from the actual nuclear industry than it necessarily is from government, because there's still this concern about dealing with nuclear waste. I mean, it's a realistic concern. It is an issue to deal with.
Yep.
But having a proliferation of reactors, I'm not so sure I'm all for that. But I mean, I don't have anything against nuclear power at all. I actually think nuclear power is a sensible solution as long as we can appropriately dispose of the wastes. But this is something that a lot of people in the industry are talking about.
And nuclear waste, I mean, no one's been able to come up with a definitive answer on how to deal with this yet.
No, because the fundamental issue is when you have wastes that maintain radioactivity for in some cases, up to tens of thousands of years, then you're looking at basically disposing of these this waste in something that is geologically stable for tens of thousands of years. And we don't have the information about earthquakes and so on in a given region because we've only been able to measure things in the last, I don't know, a few decades. So you have to extrapolate. Now, there are sort of certain areas with like bedrock and so on where you could conceivably do it. But then it becomes very expensive to drill these places out and build all of these underground storage sites and so on. So this is not a cheap thing to do either. So you get back to, is it economical to do in the end? And so it's a challenge. Let's put it that way.
All right. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. James, stay there. We'll get to you coming up after the news. But we have to take a quick break right now. We've got a news update for you. Then more. Science Files with Dr. Rob. We'll be back after the news, and the news is coming up next. So Monday morning, Science File with Dr. Rob Thacker. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877.
And the Jetsons, apparently.
And the Jetsons, that's right. 1-877-801-8255. Meet the Jetsons. Anyway, I can't remember the rest of them. James, good morning. Hello,
how's
James.
Going?
I'm going, doing well, sir. How are you?
Pretty good. I just had a small question. I'm kind of a compulsive YouTube watcher. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I find myself stumbling upon some pretty interesting stuff. One of the things I was wondering if we could maybe see if this is, you know, more of just like a hoax thing, or it's these horns, I guess. I've been basically, you know, finding them in different areas of the world. I guess people are hearing them in the sky or whatever the heck it is. I can't really put my finger on it. I just want to see if there's an explanation for it. It just seems that usually it's in the daytime that there's these, I guess, these horn sounds like kind of resonating through the sky. And I don't know if that's something to do with, you know, if there's a, you know, a relative explanation for it, or if it's just something that unexplained and people are just kind of catching it on camera. But there is video evidence of it happening in different parts of the world. I just wasn't sure if this is something that, you know, that's a natural occurrence, or is this something that we don't know what's going on?
Or another conspiracy theory, maybe. Dr. Rob says.
I just, honestly, the first I've heard about it. So,
I do remember back in the late 70s, early 80s, there used to be these sonic booms off the coast of Nova Scotia. Nobody could figure it out until they put two and two together with the Concorde.
Yeah.
And the Concorde created the sonic boom.
So, I mean, it's anywhere around aircraft testing areas and so on, then you always have that possibility as well. But I mean, there are sort of like things that go bang in the night, as it were, which are literally planes. But there are all sorts of limits on civil aviation and breaking the sound barrier and so on. But I haven't heard anything about this personally. I would say be mega, mega careful spending too much time on YouTube, because there's an awful lot of, like, if you think the History Channel is bad, like, YouTube is like the History Channel.
Well, what
steroids.
Do you mean the History Channel's bad?
There's a lot of rubbish on the History Channel, right? Conspiracy theory rubbish on the History Channel. Sorry, I'm just saying it. So anyway, I mean, it's fun TV, like it's aliens. And it's entertaining TV as long as you don't take it too seriously. But YouTube people just amp it up. I mean,
Here's what I've just Googled. Horns in the sky.
Yeah. Horns in the sky.
And they say there's a source behind a mystery sound heard around the world. Can you hear the mysterious global hum? What is the mysterious global hum? Is it simply noise pollution?
You know why it's humming?
Why?
Because it doesn't know the words.
Okay. But apparently there are people are hearing, and this goes back to 2016, but here's one, November 10th, 2019. Why are people hearing strange jet-like, let me just click onto this, jet-like sky sounds but not seeing planes? So there's obviously something happening up there.
Well, I mean, you can certainly have jet sounds when you have low cloud and you can't see the plane. That happens all the time, right? Especially over Nova Scotia.
Yeah. We get something like 900 flights over this province each and every day.
Mm-hmm. We are under a major current. In fact, that's actually one of the interesting things behind the spaceport in Canso being not such a great idea, because there's so much air traffic.
Okay. Yeah. Here's another one. They talk about conspiracy theories. Are the sky trumpets people have been reporting signs of the end of the world?
Okay.
But there are some sounds that are being heard out there, and nobody can be able to figure it out.
Like I said, I mean, it's there can be sounds, and you don't know where it's coming from. That does happen. I mean, it's the same thing with the term UFO, right? There can be a light in the sky, and you don't know what it is, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's aliens. Yeah. Okay.
All right, let's go to the phones again, and Brian's on the line. Morning, Brian.
Morning.
How are you today, sir?
I'm excellent.
Good.
And I love this part of your show. It's my favorite part.
Okay.
And after that, it would be the call-in part. That's really good. But my question is this. I was listening to you talk about the nuclear waste and how to dispose of it. And I'm just wondering, why can't we take the nuclear waste and drop it in, like, say, the Kilauea volcano that doesn't erupt in a huge explosion, but you know, wouldn't it get consumed in the lava in the volcano?
All right, good question.
Okay, so I know why you're saying that, but at the end of the day, what you end up creating is radioactive lava. Right. And lava is bad enough. You don't want radioactive lava. And so the argument for like dropping it into the caldera and then what would happen to it. Remember, the caldera has recently emptied. Right. And a hell heck of a lot of lava is just waiting to come out somewhere and we don't know. So that's the main reason. The other thing that people often talk about is, why can't we blast it into the sun? I mean, that's a little bit of a less. Well. It's a better disposal mechanism, let's put it that way. But the problem with it is you then have to launch this stuff and 1 in 100 launches is going to go wrong and basically you blow a bunch of nuclear waste everywhere. So again, you don't want to do that either.
Yeah. No easy answer to this question.
So containing it is the best thing you can do. And the problem is the long-term containment. And so you go through a series of questions about like the actual vessel, how long does the vessel last? Once you've done how long the vessel lasts, how long does the area in which it's stored in last, right? Is there some kind of erosion? Could some water leak through and flush it and move it somewhere else? All of those questions have to be worked out, and that's the challenge because you're looking at enormous timescales.
I remember it was some years back there was a study or talk about hollowing out some of the rock in the Canadian Shield. Mm-hmm. And disposing of the reactor waste in those.
Right. And so that would be, in theory, addressing a number of issues because you're not going to have too much stuff permeating through that particular bedrock, but it's going to be expensive to do.
Yeah.
Right.
And again, as more and more of these nuclear plants that continue to produce more and more of this stuff, it's a problem. So
this is where, I mean, we've talked about the problems with uranium being some of the decay products just are around for so long. I mean, there are alternative conventional fission reactors. Well, not conventional. They're not conventional, but alternative fission reactor fuels such as thorium, which have less radioactive byproducts in terms of their overall half-lives.
And that's Chris's question here this morning. He emails to say he'd love to hear your opinion on modular thorium reactors. And if we should get us some of them here in Nova Scotia.
Well, I mean, we have a provincial mandate that we can't have nuclear power, don't we? So I think potentially if you were going to go with a technology that was going to see a big proliferation, I would be more inclined towards thorium than I would be traditional uranium processes. And the main reason is that the reactor wastes don't have as long a half-life and should be somewhat easier to dispose of. Where people are pointing out thorium is no safer than the uranium is that you can potentially create fissionable weapons from the fuel using thorium fuel as well. So you could potentially use this to create things that were basically detonatable in nuclear weapons. And so that's one of the concerns with proliferation of nuclear power in general is what would happen to the overall nuclear safety, as it were. And so this is always something that is basically a big concern for the future of the nuclear industry. How do you stop proliferation and creation of waste? One of the reasons why uranium was adopted was because you could actually use it to actually create nuclear weapons. And so this is not something that's perfect with thorium. Thorium was initially said, and there'll be no chance of nuclear proliferation with thorium reactors. But there's been a study done that says, actually, there are reaction pathways where even with some relatively low-grade laboratory technologies, you could create fissionable products that would allow people to create weapons, even dirty weapons that didn't really go fully critical. So it's a concern. But what are you going to do? No technology is perfect.
Yeah.
You look at all of the issues with like coal, oil, gas, and everything. All of those have byproducts. The thing that we often forget about with all of these things is the stuff that goes into the air, the particulate, actually ends up causing or being part of the cause of lung damage down the road for some people. How many people? Good question. The epidemiology of that is difficult, but nonetheless, it's a factor.
Are the thorium reactors in operation now?
No, it's a different technology to the pressurized water reactors that are particularly common.
So is it still in experimental stage? It
would be best to say, so they built experimental reactors decades ago, and there are now a number of basically companies and countries around the world that are looking at developing new thorium reactors.
And the thorium that's necessary for these reactors, how abundant is it?
It's in a lot of different countries around the world. I think India has very big deposits. China has very big deposits, if I remember correctly. But it's not something where we would be worried about running out of it, right? There's enough of it in the Earth's crust that in theory it should be able to keep us. I think someone said like tens of thousands of years or 10,000 years is the estimate or something.
But I mean, what's the holdback here then? Why aren't we adopting these things?
Well, okay, it's not perfect from the nuclear proliferation viewpoint, as I said. And the second thing is you have an industry that runs on uranium already.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not easy. And you have provincial rules like we have of no nuclear reactors. So, right? Not everyone is going to want to have a nuclear power plant. And, okay, I get why some people are skeptical.
That policy in Nova Scotia, by the way, no nuclear reactors in this province. It goes back to the John Buchanan days, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
That goes back to like 1978, 79. So maybe time to have a revisit on that policy.
Well, I think the way things are going to go, what we're going to see is we're going to see an increase in renewables, right, solar, wind, and so on. But there will still have to be this support of other technologies to keep the grid going. And I wouldn't be surprised if nuclear does end up filling that gap.
10:45 is our time, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Dr. Rob Thacker with us here on a Monday morning. We'll be back with more Science Files right after this quick break. Well, it's not exactly weird science, but it is science. This is Science Files here on a Monday morning with Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University. And Josh is on the line with a comment or a question here this morning. Hi, Josh.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing today?
Very good. Just enjoying the show. Thought I'd pitch in a little bit.
All right, okay. Go ahead.
I kind of had a chuckle when Dr. Rob there mentioned the History Channel and, you know what I mean, aliens, ooh, and whatever. And I kind of had a laugh because, in my opinion, Mr. Dr. Rob there sounds like a pretty rational, you know what I mean, clear-thinking human being. And in my opinion, based on what we know about the scope of space and its size and its, you know what I mean, the vastness, it's infinite. It's what we know is infinite. So I just think that knowing what we know about already about, like, say, spores and tardigrades and these beings that have been able to, they can survive the conditions that, you know what I mean, can pass through the vacuum and travel amongst the space, and the fact that comets are loaded with ice, okay, and they're hurling around, you, in my opinion, you'd have to be pretty rational to think that there is other life out there.
I appreciate the call, Josh. Thank you. And
well, okay, I can completely respond to that.
And the meteors that he talks about, I mean, when they crashed on the Earth as Earth was forming, they helped contribute to the life.
So all of the things you said, I don't really have a significant issue with, right? What is an issue for me is the idea of intelligent aliens. I totally believe that within yours, probably in my lifetime, we will know that there is life on other planets around other stars. Right. And we'll do that by making measurements of the atmospheres of those planets and finding evidence of things like oxygen and free oxygen in the atmosphere and things like that. Mm-hmm. Now, where things get more complicated is, you know, can we have comets coming around that are actually sort of like bringing life to us? This is that is actually a theory called panspermia. It goes back to Fred Hoyle and Wick Grand and Singy. And so the only concern I have with that particular theory is that the comets actually come from the Oort cloud, which is just basically kind of like a halo of all of these icy bodies around the solar system. And so they start out very, very far away, and they're coming into the inner solar system. And so the probability of those bringing life into our solar system is fairly close to zero unless they come from another star system. And so that, you know, yeah, sure, that could happen every now and again. But what's not likely to happen is that something will be a comet come down, hit a planet and bounce off and go again. You know that's not going to happen. Once a comet hits a planet, a comet gets wiped out. So the possibility of transfer between the Earth and Mars, that's possible, and we know it happens, to be honest, because there are ejecta that actually correspond to Martian geology that we found on Earth, and likewise, I believe there's it's harder. The energy doesn't work for stuff going from Earth to Mars, but it does for Mars to Earth because we're closer to the Sun, and so. So those kind of things are all very sensible. And I do believe that there will be life found on other planets around other stars within my lifetime. But what I don't believe is like there's high technology beings coming here all of the time and lights in the sky are those things. I just think that's just an illogical step. Let's put it that way.
You think there'd be microbial life as opposed to an ET out there?
Yeah. And let me explain the reasoning behind that. So the reasoning behind that is if you look at the geological record of the Earth, life got going on the Earth as bacteria very, very quickly, like within a few hundred million years, whereas the complex forms of life that form you and I and animals and so on, those took a much longer time and may have required a series of coincidences that were really rare. And so we don't in general expect to see that kind of life. In fact, it would be difficult for us to find evidence of that kind of life anyway. But certainly evidence of bacterial life is something that we can go and look for just because they change the entire planet the same way trees, bacteria, things in the ocean change the entire nature of our atmosphere. So we would expect that to happen perhaps on other planets as well.
Hopefully that answers your question, Josh.
Yeah, it kind of does. I'm glad he mentioned the part about all the aliens, because another question I just quickly was Paul Hellyer, our former defense minister. He has some, you know what I mean?
He believes in the UFOs.
Exactly, but like the potential, how he spoke about how many species have been documented, it just seems very odd. And like I understand that microbial, obviously, that'd be more likely. But as far as I understand, our planet is relatively new, and we've actually already found planets that are much larger than us, very close to us, or that are similar to Earth. So
the possibility
so
is
much
out there.
That space and time. Yeah. Oh, it's in my opinion, it's almost an absolute.
I appreciate the call, Josh. Thank you.
So based upon probability alone and our own geological record, that's a reasonable conclusion.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Someday, we'll get a visit.
I don't agree with, but I think that we will know about whether there's life on other planets.
Indeed. Let's talk about, what are we here now? We're coming up to winter, but are we into the meteorological or the astronomical
season?
Ooh,
that's a good question.
I've never been able
difference.
To figure
right,
this
right.
one
so,
out.
So here. I was actually speaking with colleagues about this, and which system of seasons do people really use? And I actually think people really use the meteorological seasons.
Which is December 21st is winter.
Well, no, that's the astronomical.
Oh, okay.
Right? So that's the winter solstice that you're thinking about.
All right.
And so with the winter solstice, from December 21st onwards, then you're into winter. Whereas most of us, I think we say, well, December 1st, that's pretty much when winter starts as far as we're concerned.
So that's the
meteorological definition. And so the meteorological definition is based upon average temperature over 3 months.
Yeah.
Right. And so when you look at the coldest temperatures, then you essentially get December, January, February, although obviously March can be cold sometimes. And so you build it around those particular definitions, whereas the astronomical seasons are different. They're defined in terms of where the Earth essentially is around the Sun. So when we're actually in the middle of the summer, then we're kind of leaning most towards the Sun in terms of the axial tilt in the Northern Hemisphere. And then when we're leaning farthest away from the Sun in terms of our axial tilt relative to the height of the Sun, then that's when we're at winter.
Okay.
And so that is when the Sun is necessarily low in the sky in the winter, and the flip side, it's very high in the sky in the summer, right? And so the equinoxes are sort of the two halfway points between those when you have equal night and dark.
Okay. So we're in a meteorological winter.
But we're still in astronomical fall, I would guess.
Yeah, and the astronomical winter begins on
December 21st.
December 21st.
Yep.
Okay. That clarifies things, I think.
Yeah. So now you can have an argument about, is it winter or not?
Well, no matter whether you call it an astronomical or even though the weather outside is winter-like, that's...
Yeah, no, like I said, I think people really do, because I often get a little bit sort of like weirded out when I think of fall going all the way into December, because I really don't think the fall feels like it goes all the way into December.
But we've got about 2 minutes left here, and Patrick just emailed. Says he heard that Earth's position in the solar system is fairly different when we look at similarly sized planets in other solar systems. Could this be related to the theory that states the moon was formed when a large body collided with Earth? Could this have altered Earth's orbit so that it was closer to the sun?
Okay, so that's a completely reasonable question. The short answer is I don't honestly feel we have enough information to make really good assertions about the general orbital properties of planets like the Earth. For a long time, we were finding them using a method that really did bias towards finding planets that were very close into their star. We do have other methods now, the transit method, which allows us to capture a lot more stars, but then everything has to have nice follow-up, and we have to establish that we actually know the overall size of that planet and its overall distance from the star as well. So I'm not entirely convinced that we have a good enough census of planets like the Earth around other stars quite yet. But in general, the solar system seems to be a bit unusual at the moment. And there seems to be perhaps more planets than a lot of the systems we've said. Although, again, we're always limited by the fact that we can only see something like a Jupiter planet if we spend long enough looking for its signal, right? And for most of the missions that we've done so far and experiments that we've done so far, you don't tend to find really long period objects unless you look for a very, very long time. Now, there are some studies that have done that. And in fact, there was, for the Nobel Prize this year, there was given to Mayol and Kellos for the first discovery of a planet around a star other than the sun. And so there were competing Canadian researchers who had built a brilliant piece of instrumentation to actually detect planets like Jupiter. But the problem was it just took so long to detect anything that they had a really weak signal, but no one would agree that it was actually there. And eventually they wrote a paper saying, oh, we don't think it's there. We think it could be some stellar pulsation. But then a few years later, they went, it is there. Right. And they were really happy that they found it. But by then it was too late. Right. So they kind of didn't get the Nobel Prize because they were good scientists.
Yeah.
And they said, we think there are problems here. And so anyway.
Fascinating story. Yeah. Dr. Rob, as always, another interesting hour flies right by. And you'll be back with us again next
Absolutely.
Monday.
Absolutely. Yep.
Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University and Science Files each and every Monday right here on News 95.7. Join us next Monday for more with Dr. Rob. 2 minutes now before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We've got our first open hour of the day of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday, and that means anything goes here this morning. Our phone lines await your calls at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take your calls after the news. The news is coming up next.